Advocating for women's rights and equality is at the heart of everything outspoken feminist Clementine Ford says and does. Her new book, Fight Like a Girl, gives support, advice and personal anecdotes to women and men on how not to just stand by, but to take charge and push for balance.
One of the first things that women need to do is recognise that we have this extraordinary power and this extraordinary strength. And every which way, we are told to kind of hide it and to shield it and to even pretend that it doesn't exist. And all of that is done in an attempt to keep us nice and sweet and going along with the way that things are, quote unquote. But of course, that's ridiculous. And it actually makes a lot of women really unhappy. I was reading this horrible interview with the even more horrible Milo Yiannopoulos. He was profiled in The Nation, and I have no idea why legitimate news outlets pay any attention to him at all. He repeated the ridiculous assertion that so many people hold on to, which is that feminism is making women unhappy and that we can track this through data. And the more women are exposed to feminism, the unhappier they become because, you know, deep down women just want this, blah, blah, blah. If women are expressing a greater level of unhappiness, it's because they feel empowered to express a greater level of unhappiness. But it's not because of all this equality and freedom that we've supposedly got, even though we don't actually have it. It's precisely because we recognize now that we have a right to self-determination, we have a right to dignity, and we're reacting against the way that we're still treated as if we're second-class citizens. We're still treated as if our job is there to be the supporting players to men's great story and to sit there and laugh at all the right points and to be active participants in our own degradation. That's what makes women unhappy. What makes women unhappy isn't that, as some people say, that, oh, well, we get to our 30s and we've tried to have a career and now we've missed out on a family, or we're trying to balance both and women can't have it all. It's those conversations that make women unhappy. Why are we even focusing on this silly idea of can women have it all? Of course women can't have it all. Men shouldn't be able to have it all either. No one can have it all. What we can do and what we should all be supported to, every last one of us, is to be able to seek and carve out a life that is authentic to what our desires are and that has some kind of integrity to it. And the fact is that women still all over the world have to perform the bulk of the world's not only domestic unpaid labor, but emotional unpaid labor. There's all these things that are, you know, still conspiring to keep women down. That's what makes us unhappy and frustrated. So the idea of fighting like a girl is recognizing all of those things and also realizing that actually the fact that we've made it to this point and that we've survived this far and that we continue to survive really against the odds in terms of what the biggest threats to us are, is testament to our enormous strength and capabilities. So I feel like that's a very long answer to the question, and the short answer is that fighting like a girl is recognizing the strength that's been forged within us over millennia of oppression and really utilizing that to take back what belongs to us.
You've been a staunch feminist, an outspoken feminist for a long time, and in the book you talk about the abuse that's been hurled at you and is hurled at you constantly. 15 years on, you've built this coat of armour, I guess, around yourself to be able to deal with it. For people who are feeling inspired to stand up more and become stronger feminists, more outspoken feminists, at the start of that journey, can you reflect on how you first dealt with those slings and arrows?
Once you've heard it so many times, it just becomes white noise, really. But I had the advantage of starting out on this path before social media was what it is today. So it was kind of like the opportunities that people had to abuse me were in much smaller doses. It was almost like a vaccine, you know. I could become immune by having a bit of the live disease sort of just injected into me in small, small rates. Whereas now, you know, a 14-year-old girl who is looking to stand up for herself not only has to deal with all of the stuff that women have always had to deal with, but she has to deal with this incredibly toxic environment online as well. And the online space can be a marvelous thing, and it certainly has been an incredibly empowering thing for women and for female communities. But there's the flip side of this really toxic underbelly that's used not only to express the most base of humanity's kind of grotesqueness, but also in a very specific driven way is used as a backlash against women's empowerment in the men and boys primarily who fill those communities. So it's a really different prospect for her to kind of come up against what was for me like a little hill of abuse is actually now mountains and mountains of it. So I would suggest that the best thing that she can do is to not take it upon herself to have to fight all of the battles all at once, because that is the quickest way to become really demoralized and really defeated and just feel really bad about yourself. You know, that's at the point where girls and women turn their accounts off and they exit the online space, which ironically is the advice that we're always given. Oh, well, why don't you just get off the internet? As if, A, it's our responsibility to remove ourselves from abusive situations and not the responsibility of a society to demand that those situations not be abusive. And B, as if the online space is some kind of like very peripheral environment where we can dip in and out of it if we choose and it will not really have any impact on our life. That's ridiculous. The online space is indistinguishable now from the offline space in terms of social interactment and in terms especially of business. So we can't as women just remove ourselves from it, and nor should we have to, in order to avoid being called, you know, a disgusting, gross, ugly cum dumpster. You know, apologies to listeners out there, but those are the kinds of things that are being said online to girls. Or, you know, someone who needs to have a fist up her ass to shut her up. That kind of stuff. I mean, this is all stuff that I've seen said in public Facebook groups this week to young girls by young boys. I feel like what needs to happen is, firstly, that girl shouldn't be responsible for taking on all of those fights all by herself. And she shouldn't be responsible for that because as a society, we should be fighting against it. We should be providing that support. That is what a decent, good society does. It's not one that says, oh, well, boys will be boys, or get off the internet, or let's just turn our back on it, or let's just ignore it. Because what ends up happening then is that these cycles just keep getting repeated, but also the entitlement keeps getting doubled down on, you know. So you have these communities of people who exercise this kind of abuse thinking, well, we can get away with it. There's literally nothing that anyone will do to stop us. So why would we stop? So maybe that person who is looking to start out in that fighting back kind of capacity can start in small ways in her own communities, in her own circles of friends, challenging sexism here and there where she sees it without feeling like it's her responsibility to take on the world. But also the biggest point that I say to everyone actually is that you will not win that fight by being earnest. As unfortunate as that is and as cynical as that is, those people feed off of your earnestness. Those people feed off of the fact that this is something that matters to you, that you care about this, that you actually have a stake in this game. If you give them a glimpse of your emotional side in that capacity, if you give them a glimpse of your heart, then they'll just suck it dry. But if you laugh at them, if you make them out to be the ridiculous object, if you make them out to be a person who is beneath your contempt, then they hate that. And they really start to shrivel up when that happens. And they do fight back in stronger ways, but the more immune you become to those words and the more you realize that they are an object of ridicule. They are an absurd state of being. They are terrified and scared and angry, and these are the things that are driving them. And that actually makes them a pitiful, pathetic person. Then you suddenly have power not only over them, but you have it over yourself again.
You've notoriously named and shamed and screenshot online to make people aware of the kind of comments that you have copped over time. Do you recommend that as a recourse?
I do advocate very much the idea of screenshotting and signal boosting the words and the actions that are used against women in particular. And anyone can do that in any capacity of feeling like they're being abused online or whatever. But obviously my gig is advocating for women. And the reason that I do that is because I think that there are so few avenues that have been provided to us where we feel like anything will be done to protect the female users of these services. So we have to take matters into our own hands. And we've been forced to do that, really. And people will call that, oh, that's vigilante justice. But no, it's not really. Someone says something to you and they operate in a realm in which they need those words to be kept private. And that is what abuse is all about, whether or not it happens online or offline, whatever it is. Abuse is predicated on power. The power that they have over you to keep you silent by keeping you humiliated. And then they can just go on their merry way and keep doing it to other people. Well, why should they be able to get away with that? If no one else is making these people be accountable for their actions, then I'm sorry, but we have to be able to be responsible for that. We have to not be further abused for standing up for ourselves and saying that we deserve better treatment than this. And also, if you're too ashamed by having your words blasted out for everyone to see, don't send them to people privately. If you don't want people to see in 10-foot high letters that you think that someone is one of those things that I said before that I won't repeat, or you don't want someone to see your unsolicited sent picture of your penis in widescreen, then don't send it. That's very simple. It's really, really easy. So everyone who gets really stressed out and upset and outraged by this idea that women might be fighting back by putting men's words on blast for everyone else to see, the really simple solution to that is don't do it in the first place.
Standing strong and actually following it through and backing yourself when you know you've done something right. That's the message, isn't it? You know, stand by your convictions.
And the thing is as well that the fact that women are fighting back now in this way is really powerful and sends a message too. And it's and certainly should be sending a message to people at Facebook, for example. Because again, like with any kind of method of harassment or abuse, particularly when it's been gendered, it's been really easy to pretend that the problem isn't as big as it is because women are quiet about it. You know, we do just sort of skulk off and close our accounts and close the curtains on our life and feel shit about ourselves and feel like there was something that I did that made this happen. And no one gets to hear those stories. So then when other women speak up, everyone's like, ugh, well, you know, you're just overreacting. Everyone else kind of deals with this and just gets on with it. But you're the one who's making a big deal, which means that you're too sensitive. When actually the people who are making a big deal are the ones who are prepared to kind of take on the system and take on people's double standards because they're sick of it.
How do you meet that challenge to raise it not just amongst women who understand it already, but to ensure that men actually get it? That whole concept of the good guy, I guess, and understanding that actually just being good isn't enough in the world that we live in.
Or rather, just not being bad isn't enough. I found that since I stopped catering to men's feelings, a lot more of them have come on board with my brand of feminism. That previously, when I made sure to reassure everyone that I didn't mean all men, that I knew that most men, where you get that figure most from is just something that we pluck out of the air, but I knew that most men were good, decent men, et cetera, et cetera. They would never do anything to hurt a woman, blah, blah, blah. All you end up doing when you kind of use that language is reassuring the men who want to believe that they're good men, but who are actually just not bad men, but not doing anything demonstrable or productive to improve the situation for women, all you end up doing is reassuring them that they're not part of the problem and therefore they don't need to be part of the solution. You're literally giving them license to pat themselves on the back for being a good guy and then go along their merry way. And then nothing gets done. So when I stopped doing that and when I started saying, it's not enough for you to just not be a bad guy, you have to engage with your privilege. I'm not going to give you cookies. I'm not going to give you pats on the back. And yes, you do need to acknowledge that this is a problem that all men are part of, even if you are not personally perpetrating it. And so what are you going to do about that? It made a lot of men really uncomfortable and makes a lot of men really angry, but it also makes a lot of men go, whoa, huh, I feel really confronted by this. And I'm actually going to think about the situation because I do value myself as a good man. But what does that mean? What does that mean to me to be a good man? And if I want to continue being a good man, how do I make that happen? So I think that that is actually the interesting part of it, is that I do believe that there are men out there who have the capacity to be really good, but they need to be challenged in an environment and in a society which makes it so easy for men to do nothing. They need to be challenged to do more, and the good ones will actually step up and have done so. They still don't get cookies and rewards because it's just basically doing the right thing. So that is possible to make that happen in your own life. And what I wanted to do with this book, and some of the feedback has demonstrated that I've certainly succeeded with some of the readers, is to provide the women who do get it, who do understand, to provide them with some of the language that they may not have had before. to articulate those ideas or those frustrations. And then they can have those conversations with the men in their lives. And also men can read this book as well and have the conversations with men in their lives too and take the message out that way, kind of like expanding it drip by drip. And, you know, the other thing as well is that even when you know something and you recognize something, it can be really reassuring to be told that someone else recognizes it as well. One of the biggest hurts I feel that I suffer as a woman and that I think other women suffer is the hurt of being diminished, the hurt of being erased. So our experiences, when we share them and when we talk about the harassment or the abuse or the discrimination that we experience, we're invariably told by at least one person that we're overreacting to it, or we're even making it up, or we're not properly understanding the situation somehow, that other people who certainly weren't there and who don't even know us are better able to explain that situation to us. That is very hurtful and that is very demoralizing. So to read something like this, I hope, will tell other women out there that those feelings that you're having, they're real. I have them as well. I recognize your struggle. Don't let anyone diminish it to you. Don't let anyone tell you that it's all in your head, because it's not. These things are real to us. And so hopefully that will galvanize the women who are reading it and make them better able to stand strong in that truth, I guess, because we can succumb so easily to second guessing ourselves. Even I do it now. You know, I must sound to people like I'm really a stalwart, strong person. But even now I'll go over something in my head, and just because of all those years of conditioning of being a girl and being forced to second guess every experience I have in case it makes someone uncomfortable, even now I'll feel like, oh, well, did I imagine that man's hand on my butt when he was hugging me? Or did I imagine this thing happening? Did I imagine that tone of condescension coming from that person? I probably just overreacting a little bit, you know? And then what the danger of that is, that it ends up leading to situations where, you know, this is the kind of the big macro problem, is that when you live in a world that tells women to second guess their instincts all the time for fear of their quote unquote overreaction upsetting a man or making a man feel like he might be implicated somehow in violence against women. How dare you make me feel bad? What you end up doing then is having girls and women who are second-guessing themselves when they have instincts walking down a dark street at nighttime. What you end up having are girls and women who speak to men on the street, who approach them because they either feel a little uncomfortable but they don't want to make a sudden move, or there's that voice in their head saying, oh, he's probably just being nice. You know, I don't want to hurt his feelings. I don't want to make him feel bad. You know, I don't want to make this awkward, so I'll just keep talking to him. And, you know, probably most of the time, nothing bad's going to happen there, because the biggest risk to girls and women is in their homes and amongst the men that they know. But every so often, you'll have a situation where Jill Maher happens, you know, where Jill Maher or someone like Jill Maher feels like she needs to speak to that man because, or she can't call out in a busy street and say, this man is bothering me. Can someone stop him from bothering me? Because there's that voice in her head that says, don't overreact. Don't make a scene. Don't make this man feel bad. And look, if one or two well-intentioned men feel bad, that's a small price to pay. But also, maybe men should just stop approaching strange women on the street until we reach a situation where women do not actually have to fear all of these additional things and all of these additional threats. Maybe, just maybe, men could just control themselves. Like, you don't need to speak to a woman on the street. You might want to live in a world where everyone has the freedom to do that, and that would be great. We all want to live in that world. But until we get there, maybe don't prioritize your needs to have your ego satisfied by needing to speak to a woman on the street or make her take her headphones out, or all of these tiny little microaggressions that happen to us all the time that end up just kind of like wearing women down, so that we get to the point where we don't even know whether or not what we're feeling is accurate.
Another message I got really strongly from the book is the need and the priority we need to give our girls. In a lot of cases, that understanding of the strength of relationships with women and with a broad range of women often comes as you become an older person.
Mm.
Younger girls find it harder to recognize one another as strengthening to one another. They fight against one another rather than fight with one another. What do you think feeds into that, and how could women find that strength in those relationships earlier in their life, because they are so sustaining and important?
I think one of the worst things that is repeated ad infinitum until it becomes, in people's eyes, truth, when I don't think that it is true, is that saying that women are each other's own worst enemies. That, oh, you know, when it comes down to it, women are worse to each other than anyone else. That's rubbish. Women's worst enemy is patriarchy, and the biggest threat to women is men. That's not to say that individual men are horrendous and women should stay away from them, but as a species, the biggest predator to women is men. And it's obfuscation to suggest that somehow the thing that we should be really scared of is each other. Because the reason that that message is kind of like drummed into our heads from an early age is because it keeps us separated and it keeps us invested in propping up the patriarchy, because instead of working together as women to try and forge something new, we're instead trying to navigate and negotiate our way to get some kind of power within a system that we instinctively know is designed against us. If we perceive that there is only a certain amount of the pie for women, say 30%, because across the board, in terms of representation, it's the split is about 30 to 70%, generally speaking. That's, you know, throughout media, throughout business, throughout pop culture. Instead of saying, well, hey, actually, we deserve 50% and we need to take 20% off of those men, or we need to like restructure the world so that it's equal for everybody. Instead, fight for space within that 30%. And we do it by fighting against other women. Because if we perceive that there's only a certain amount of room, then of course we perceive other women as being our competition to get there. It's like the race to be the official woman in any boys group, you know, or any boys clubhouse. And one of the reasons why it's so important for the patriarchy to prop that up is because not only does the patriarchy require women's complicity in order to survive, because women are actually dominant in terms of numbers. So what could we achieve if we worked together? But it's also threatening to people's understanding of how the world works, because until you have not even a feminist understanding, but until you kind of like unlock the permission in your brain to recognize the state of inequality in the world, what so many people do is they perceive that that correction of inequality, so that there's actually a 50-50 split as opposed to a 30-70 split, is somehow taking things away from men, and therefore how can that be equality? If you have to take 20% away from men, that's not fair. That's not equal. And why should men have to suffer? Because that's the small way that so many people want to conceive of that in their mind, that men have to lose something or men are suffering, and we need to figure out a way to equality somehow that doesn't involve men losing anything. And that's why it takes so bloody long, because that is impossible. It's impossible to create a situation where 30 to 70 becomes 50-50 without the 70% losing something. That's a mathematical impossibility. And so everyone kind of skirts around that and, you know, does these silly programs like He for She and White Ribbon and all this kind of crap that pretends that something is changing when actually nothing is changing, when the structural power is still in place and we've just got this sort of nominal nod to equality. And nothing really gets done.
Clementine Ford, author of Fight Like a Girl, which is published by Allen and Unwin and available now.